Good day, citizens, and welcome to this edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast.
We'll be mercifully brief. I must be rushing out to the Badlands of Dakota for an important meeting.
Yes. Keep your eyes out for Bo Wright. He's going to be out there.
I will look for him.
Yeah.
We talked to him from time to time. He's in Virginia.
Yeah.
I think down at near Poplar Forest.
Yep.
And he used to work for the Obama White House.
He was our insider at the White House.
And now he's a young idealist trying to save democracy against all of the forces that are against it. But I'm heading there. But this was a fascinating, fascinating program. You know, we're doing a series of interviews of authors. This is a book by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. They're joint authors. They've done a number of books together, including a one you love on Red Cloud.
Yeah. If you want to read a great book on the American Plains and the history of Native Americans, it's called The Heart of Everything That Is. Best single volume I've ever read about Red Cloud, for sure.
And this one is called Valley Forge. It doesn't have a subtitle. It's the story of that moment in the winter of 1777, 1778, the darkest moment of the entire Revolution, when George Washington was in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, with 12,000 troops, 2,000 of whom died or deserted.
And this is
smallpox.
Not a dry read.
Hunger,
it's just
desperation.
We talked
mutiny.
During the conversation about how they did such great character studies of all of these individuals, and you learn so much about all of these individuals. I really enjoyed this book very, very much.
I did too. They're terrific. We want to have them back on the program, and we've nominated this, as you know, as a
we
book
don't
club
have to
selection.
Nominate.
It's already in.
It's up to you.
Well, it's in. And so we want people to.
We're a little late.
If you haven't already read the book, read it now.
Yeah.
And then let us know what you thought and send
we'll
us questions.
Do a follow-up
and
follow up.
We could do follow up with these two men. I think they would take our call.
Yeah. We need to get back to our listeners. Our mail stack is rising and rising, but we've had so many special shows lately with authors.
And speaking of books, just to say the winter retreats at Lockshaw Lodge are coming, one on water in the West. That's January 13th through 18th. And January 19th through 23rd. These are the book clubs you always wanted to have. Playful, humorous conversation about serious ideas in American history. One, water, and the other, well, not American history at all, Shakespeare. I love doing these, David. And people always say to me, isn't it awfully wintry up there? It's not. It's like 35 degrees, which for North Dakota is like summer. And the snow is there, but it's not. There are no blizzard conditions. There's no wind. It's like a winter paradise. And we sit around this open fire and talk about books and ideas. And then in March, there's Steinbeck's Monterey in California. That's, I think, March 2nd through 9th.
As long as you pitched, I will too.
Yes,
but
please,
I'm going to be much shorter than you. I just want to thank everyone who has taken the time to go to jeffersonhour.com and choose to support the show. We need your support.
And we are so grateful.
It's not like you and I are driving sports cars. We do it for nothing.
Well, I have a Ford Falcon out there with only three tires.
No, you don't.
No, but it's pretty close to that.
I'd love a Falcon. Anyway.
I had one as a child.
So with that, let's go to the show. And again, thank you all who have chosen to support the show. We really do appreciate it. Go to jeffersonhour.com to find out more about Clay's cultural tours. And again, the book, sir?
This book by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin, Valley Forge, published in the autumn of 2018 by Simon & Schuster. A delightful conversation with the authors. Let's go to the show.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We have a very special program this week. A couple of authors.
Yeah, we've worked out a wonderful cooperative arrangement with Simon & Schuster, and they're feeding us authors and new books that pertain in one way or another to the life of Thomas Jefferson of the founding generation. And the first book in this series, and I'm just delighted by it, David.
Me too.
It's called Valley Forge by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. They're veteran writers. They've got about 25 books between them over the course of their careers. They turn out to be just wonderful gentlemen to interview. And their book is about that moment in the winter of 1777 and the spring of 1778, when 12,000 American troops under George Washington's command were wintering at a place called Valley Forge, which was 23 miles northwest of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And that's the basis of this story. Every American school child has heard about Valley Forge and, you know, soldiers with rags on their feet and blood in the snow. But I'll tell you this, David, I had no idea until I read this book of how desperate this winter was.
And we were so pleased that they agreed to join us for the full hour. And with that, let's get to the conversation.
We're talking about the newly published Simon & Schuster volume, Valley Forge, by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin, both of them prolific authors, one who has written and or co-written and edited 9 books, the other 16. So you two bring an enormous amount of experience to this. Give us, in the shortest possible compass, the idea of what actually happened at Valley Forge.
Many people believe that there was a battle of Valley Forge. That's why it's familiar to a lot of people. Or they have the social studies view of a couple of guys freezing in the snow and George Washington on a horse watching those guys freeze in the snow. But a big reason why we feel passionate about the book is we believe that the Valley Forge experience was the major turning point of the Revolutionary War. If some people argue Washington's Crossing, some people argue Yorktown, maybe a couple of other events or battles you could throw in there. But we believe that in the research and everything that we got put into the book backs us up, that if the Continental Army had not survived that six-month encampment, that there would not have been a Revolutionary War to continue fighting in the summer of 1778. George Washington took 12,000 troops into Valley Forge in December of 77, and during the course of a horrific winter encampment, 2,000 of those soldiers died from disease, from exposure, from starvation, generally nightmarish conditions. And the main reason the Army survived, we think, is because of the integrity and leadership of George Washington. A big part of this book for us was showing him as a very human figure, a leader whose men revered him. And yes, dozens, hundreds deserted during the Valley Forge experience, but we focus more on those who stuck it out, who would not abandon George Washington, and he wouldn't abandon his troops either. And so we believe that Valley Forge was the not only the survival of the Continental Army, but the survival and revival of the American Revolution.
And Clay, this is Drury, and the only thing I would add to that is that we both contend that the characters who inhabit our book, the pages of Valley Forge, and their shared core of values were part of the most productive generation of statesmen in the history of this country. And we say this knowing full well, aware of Abraham Lincoln's team of rivals and FDR's kitchen cabinet. But these young men, and they were all young, that was another surprise to us. His homegrown generals were in their 30s. His key aides, his core, Alexander Hamilton, John Lawrence, the Marquis de Lafayette, they were 22, 23, and 20, respectively. And the fact that these young men created this nation around George Washington, who for that winter at Valley Forge was the personification of the United States government, is just an amazing story, we think.
It is an amazing story, and you've told it very well indeed. Your book reads like a novel. It brings forth a lot of new and fascinating insights. Just a couple quick, very easy follow-up questions. Why Valley Forge and not somewhere else?
Can I just say, this is I say this when I go out to speak at events. Tom and I had planned, while we were in the course of putting this project together, putting this book together, we had talked about, people are going to come to us, because we have argued with historians. And as Tom said, some will say that the surprise attack the previous Christmas on Trenton and the mop-up at Princeton, that was the key turning point of the war. Others will say Saratoga, Horatio Gates' victory over Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne up in Saratoga. Others will say it's when the French got into the war, that was the turning point. And as Tom mentioned, others will say, no, it was Yorktown, the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown. So we were figuring, how were we going to answer this? And then out of the blue, Joseph Ellis, who of course won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of George Washington, he won the National Book Award for his writings on Jefferson, as you well know, he came in with a blurb for us calling Valley Forge the existential moment in the war for independence, when the direction of American history hung in the balance. So Tom and I just decided, well, if anybody wants to argue with it, we'll give him Joseph Ellis' phone number.
That could have been your subtitle, his blurb. Amazing. All right, so let's look at this. If I were in this encampment, no food, I mean, at certain points near starvation.
No shoes.
One disease after the next, going through like waves. no clothing, you know, blood in the snow, all of that. Kind of anxiety. What are we doing here? What's the point of sitting in this godforsaken place where we are literally coming apart? I'd leave if I could. And you talk about those who try to swim the rivers or escape. Some were caught. Many just dissolved back into their lives. What is it about George Washington that enabled his charisma or his integrity or his stature to convince these frightened, half-starved men to hang on?
Well, this is Tom. I think a big reason was that quite a few of these men, I mean, there were enlistments and men that came and went. There was militias from different states that came and went. But there were quite a few of the soldiers in the Continental Army had been serving Washington since he had become the commander-in-chief a couple of years earlier. And so I think there was they had been built up this reservoir of loyalty and dedication to Washington and recognition of his integrity. You know, you compare it a little bit to the first couple of years, first two, 3 years of the Civil War, for example. In the case of the Union Army, you had commanders-in-chief that were coming and going. You know, Pope and Hooker and McClellan twice and you know, Meade. Sometimes the soldiers never knew that from the one day to the next who was their commander in chief. On the southern side, everybody knew from day to day it was Robert E. Lee. And I think there was something like that with Washington's case. He was their commander in chief. He was the most important military figure the United States had. I mean, some people, okay, you can mention Horatio Gates. Gates won that one victory. That was basically it. And the rest of his career was not very distinguished at all. Washington, even though many of his campaigns were unsuccessful and there were tough losses at the Battle of Brandywine and the Battle of Germantown, for example, he was the man. He was the leader, the military leader, and I think the spiritual leader of the Continental Army. So I think that, yes, there were some men that simply gave up and deserted, but I think there was a lot of, when we know from the evidence that there were a lot of men who stuck it out with George Washington because they believed in him, and many of them really did believe in the cause of liberty. This was not just a way to pass the time for them to put in their military service. They believed in what they were doing.
I would just add to that George Washington was willing to undergo the same deprivations as his troops. His headquarters at Valley Forge, at first it was a tent, a marquee, they called it, and then he moved into a three-bedroom farmhouse, the Potts House, and his entire staff, 16, 17, 18 people, they all lived in this cramped space together. And he didn't pull rank, so to speak. He wasn't feasting on mutton and fresh beef while his troops were starving. He was eating the same dinner of hickory nuts and a carrot and an onion. And I think it's that certain je ne sais quoi, I guess you would put it. You don't know. It's the way the troops felt about Patton, but not Ike. Ike, I'm not putting Ike down. Eisenhower was a tremendous general. But Patton inspired this personal loyalty much as George Washington did. And I think Tom put it best when he just said he was the embodiment of the American Revolution and of the United States for this winter.
Here's a question I've been thinking about in reading your book. How do two people write a book? How do you do the logistics of this?
All right, Clay, I will finally admit it. I can't hide it anymore. I have pictures of Tom. He does everything. He does the research, reporting, the writing, and then when it's time to put the byline on, I remind him that I have pictures.
The threat of exposure. Yeah. You know, that's an interesting question because we do get asked, people will think, well, do we trade chapters? Does Bob write one and I write another one? And, you know, from the very first book that we did, Halsey's Typhoon, which was published 11 years ago, we realized that you can't have four hands on a keyboard. You have to you know, write with one voice. And it was also very clear to me that writing voice should be Bob's voice. So, you know, I do the majority of the research. Bob does all the writing. I do editing and revising and, you know, the sexy stuff like the back bibliography and the photo captions and things like that. and that's we're a double play combination. And it worked with Halsey's Typhoon, and we didn't really feel a need to vary our routine up to the present day.
It's almost like, think of Henry Ford's assembly line, Clay. we'll jump into this together. And in this case, Valley Forge, or in the Red Cloud book, The Heart of Everything That Is, there are obviously no one to interview. If there are people to interview, as in our, there were still World War II vets alive during our research for Halsey's Typhoon, The Last Stand of Fox Company, there were Korean War vets alive, and Last Men Out, about the Marine security guards trapped on the Saigon Embassy in 75 on the roof. I'll do the interviewing. But you could throw me in the Library of Congress or the National Archives, and I'd probably eventually come out with what we need. But you have to send in a search party with miner's caps to find me. Whereas Tom just swims through this. He swims through these dense libraries, and between the two of us, we formed a fairly good partnership.
I really enjoyed the way you delved into the characters. And Clay said earlier, it read like a novel, and that's part of it.
We're talking with Bob Drury and Tom Clevin about their new book, Valley Forge, Simon & Schuster, 2018.
Gentlemen, we need to take a short break, but we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Welcome back to this special edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Out of character this week, we're talking with Bob Drury and Tom Clevin about their new book, Valley Forge, Simon & Schuster, 2018. I'm very much interested in some of the other characters in this story, David.
Oh, they did such a good job on that. They, you know, every book has a voice that appears in your mind as you read it, right? And this one just falls into place.
And of course, we are dedicated to our man Thomas Jefferson. But one of the surprises for me was how important a figure in this Valley Forge story Hamilton is, not just because he's Hamilton, but he wrote this masterful 13,000-word report which changed the whole structure of the American Army.
And he had great handwriting. Let's go back to the conversation. This is the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And, of course, we talk a lot about Alexander Hamilton and the squabbles between Jefferson and Hamilton. And I really enjoyed some of your details about Hamilton. At one point in the book, I can't remember exactly the words that you used, but you explained that he's kind of a crazy warrior.
John Lawrence, who is the founding father you never heard of, unfortunately, because he was killed in the waning days, weeks before the British were about to abandon Charleston, he was killed. Hamilton, Lafayette, they all had this desire, this burning desire for battlefield honors, for battlefield glory. It was just a sign of the times, so to speak. And although I was a war correspondent for 20 years, and I saw the same thing in a lot of our, geez, they all look like boys to me, our boys in Afghanistan and Iraq. You're not fighting for, Hamilton was not fighting for the concept of the United States. Lawrence was not fighting for the newly minted American flag. They were fighting for each other. And when Washington finally let them loose, they were too valuable to him to George Washington at Valley Forge for him to let them go. He needed them as aides de camp, not only for their public duties, but they helped buoy him. Washington did not show any emotion to his troops, but in that cramped Potts House headquarters, they could see the strain on him. They could see the weight on his shoulders, and have them around, I think, really pulled the commander in chief through this ugly, horrible winter. And yet, as you say, they strained. They strained. No, I want to be out on the battlefield. And because Washington was such a hands-on general, was out on the battlefield himself, even as aides-de-camp, they found themselves fighting. I mean, Lawrence made a name for himself, even in defeat at the Battle of Germantown. And, of course, Lafayette, once he was given command of a brigade, he distinguished himself also.
You also sort of infer that these were the sons that George Washington never had.
Yeah, it's interesting that the whose man has been known as the father of our country, and by the way, it was during the Valley Forge encampment that phrase was first used by a German language Pennsylvania publication, that he did not have children. When he and Martha married, he adopted her two children. She was a widow that she had with her widowed late husband. His 46th birthday took place at Valley Forge in February of 78. And he was childless, and you know, obviously by this point was destined to remain that way. And he had these young men who were, as Bob mentioned, were Lafayette was 20, Hamilton and Lawrence 22, going on 23 years old. They were probably the age, if Washington had, had sons, this is the age they would have been. And so, and they were totally devoted to him in a way that, that sons would be to fathers. And so, and he was devoted to them because he, as Bob said, they buoyed him, they supported him, their energy, their idealism, their loyalty, their desire, this burning desire for not only battlefield glory but for the cause of freedom. I mean, we refer a couple of times as a chapter in which we discuss John Laurens and refer to him as the idealist. So I think that we do call him them surrogate sons because that's the way they were. And there's a very telling moment in the Battle of Brandywine when Washington learns that Lafayette has been wounded, and he sends a surgeon up to the front to find Lafayette and says, "Treat him as if he were my own son." And that's the way he felt. An interesting little footnote, Lafayette was also one of the few people that could look Washington in the eye because Washington was like 6'3", 6'4". He towered, not only psychologically, but physically towered over everybody in any room he was in. And it was probably an extra little enjoyment for him that with Lafayette, this eager young man, and they could look each other in the eye.
Now, on that note of Washington's projection of strength, so to speak, John Adams, who was not a Washington fan, he was behind the cabal that seeked to replace Washington as commander-in-chief with Horatio Gates after Saratoga. And he once quipped that, we only made him the commander-in-chief because he's the tallest guy in every room he's in. So.
Yeah.
Typical John Adams. I want to go back to Lafayette may have been the favorite son in some ways, but Hamilton was the most brilliant of the sons, and I'm looking at your page 188. Hamilton is suffering from pneumonia, and yet he's manages to write a 13,000 word paper entitled "A Representation to the Congress, to the Committee of Congress," in which he proposes just a fundamental reorganization of the American Army. Can you talk about, first of all, Hamilton's brilliance, but also the importance of that document?
I'll just say that of all the aides, and not just Hamilton, Laurens, and Lafayette, Tench, Tilghman, there were several aides who Washington was very close to, but Hamilton was the one that he could almost finish Washington's thoughts. Washington, of course, dictated everything. He early in the war, he wrote his own letters, but then that just became too overwhelming. And one of the reasons he hired Hamilton, promoted him to lieutenant colonel, and made him an aide-de-camp was because his handwriting was so good.
Mm.
But as the two got to know each other, Washington realized that this young man can finish my thoughts for me. And although all the correspondence, and I read close to 2,000 of Washington's personal memos, personal letters, public proclamations, general orders, his correspondence with Congress, the Continental Congress, I read everything the man wrote or dictated between, I think it was July 1, 1777, and July 15, 1778. And so many of them, strikingly, bear the imprint of these are Alexander Hamilton's thoughts, as well as Washington's. I'm not taking anything away from George Washington. But Hamilton and Washington were on the same plane as far as knowing what they wanted and how to put it down on paper to convince other people, specifically the Continental Congress. The delegates needed to be convinced. They think that we're just lollygagging out here at Valley Forge. We have no food. We have no weapons. We have no clothes. Foreign officers who visited Valley Forge either to volunteer their services or to observe were shocked. When they arrived, there would be sentries. And when we say naked, we're not talking metaphorically. We're talking literally. There would be a naked sentry wrapped in an old blanket with no shoes. He'd be standing on his hat in the snow or the freezing mud. Hamilton felt this. Laurens felt this. Washington's closest aides, they all felt what Washington was feeling himself about this, if that makes any sense. I don't know if it does or not.
Well, it gives you a sense of why Hamilton later in life was the chief advocate for a very strong central government and despised Jefferson's views of states' rights and local control and militia only till actual invasion. You know, you, I think what one of the things that comes out of your book is that it would almost be impossible to exaggerate the level of chaos and suffering at Valley Forge.
It's true.
When I started reading the book, I thought, all right, you have 12,000 soldiers here. Describe for our listeners why the logistics of feeding 12,000 and clothing 12,000 proved to be almost impossible.
Well, there's several answers to that. One, the obvious one, is the supply line was run by civilians. The Continental Congress had appointed civilians. There was a general at the head of the supply stem, but they were run by civilians and they were totally corrupt. B, just a simple dearth of wagons. They didn't have horses and wagons. Even if they could get food, they had a hard time getting it to Valley Forge because they didn't have enough wagons. And C was that one of the myths is that the preceding autumn's Pennsylvania campaign had denuded Chester County, which holds Valley Forge, neighboring Montgomery County, Bucks County, had denuded all the farms of food, which was not true at all. In fact, the crop outcome for 1777 was one of the highest of the decade. But these civilian merchants, I mean, the Continental soldiers who survived Valley Forge, many of them went to their graves cursing what they called those damn Quakers. But it wasn't all Quakers. It was the merchants and the farmers in general. They didn't know which way this war was going. And if they were going to sell their merchandise, bring their cattle, droves of cattle, their poultry, their pigs, their corn, their wheat, they wanted British pounds sterling, or sometimes even gold, for this food, for this equipment. And at one point, if it wasn't for the French, before the French even got into the war, they were surreptitiously sending shoes and tents and uniforms, as well as arms, as well as guns and artillery. But that is what kept for a couple of months. It was only that that kept the Continental Army from disbanding or dissolving or starving, as Washington said in his famous letter to Congress. We are on the verge of disbanding, dissolving, or starving unless you get your act together. And finally, when Nathaniel Greene was named head of the supply system, that's when things turned around. Greene was a general from Rhode Island. He didn't want the job. He preferred battlefield glory, but he said, I'll do it for the good of the team, more or less. And he just went out and he started making sweeping changes in the supply stem. And that's when things started to turn around in the late spring of 1778.
Two things. One, earlier I mentioned that I really enjoyed the character studies that you did throughout the book. And also you're talking about the how grim it was, but you just touched on Nathaniel Greene and the changes. There's a point in the book where things turn.
A huge turning point in the Valley Forge encampment was the arrival of the Baron von Steuben, who's also known as von Steuben. So Bob, take it away, because it was the appearance of this Falstaffian character in the third week in February, when George Washington and his army were at their absolute lowest point, that made a difference.
Tom's right. I mean, George Washington is obviously my favorite character in the book, but if I have a secondary protagonist who I fell in love with, it was the Baron Friedrich Wilhelm Ludolf Gerhard Augustin von Steuben, von Steuben to you and me. When he showed up at Valley Forge in late February, first of all, he arrived in a sleigh pulled by a team of coal-black Percheron horses he had purchased in France in order to make a good entrance. And the sleigh was adorned with 24 jingle bells. And he's sitting in there with his silk tunic and two big horse pistols on his ample belly. He was a big man. And he's trailed by a retinue of servants and aides de camp and translators and even a French chef who was in Valley Forge, I think, 36 hours before he quit. He said, I'm not working here. But he also arrived in Valley Forge with a resume more doctored up than the Mayo Clinic. I mean, He had come, the French foreign minister, the Comte de Vajon, had introduced von Steuben to Ben Franklin and Franklin's associate Silas Deane in Paris. And at first they were like, no, first of all, you never rose beyond the rank of captain in Frederick the Great's Prussian army. George Washington is already sending us letters telling us, please don't send me any more of these foreign, I love this word, popinjays.
these deadbeats. Most of them were French. They had no English. They showed up in the United States expecting to be made a general. Washington couldn't stand this. But Franklin and Dean in Paris realized that von Steuben had something that no one else they had interviewed had. And that is, in Frederick the Great's army, officers spent the first 6 years of their enlistment living with the enlisted men, and thereafter getting down in the muck and mire and training with them. I mean, so when von Steuben started to explain what he could do to transform the army, the Continental Army, Franklin and Dean looked at each other and said, this is just the guy we need to make a professional force out of our disparate militias. But how are we going to present him to Washington? He's only a captain. So suddenly, those captain's bars disappeared, and they were replaced by the general stars. And von Steuben suddenly became a primary aide to Frederick the Great for over a decade, the inspector general of the Prussian army. And it was a total fraud. And of course, he realized he was going to be found out eventually. Everybody did. But by the time that von Steuben himself started to backtrack, his drilling methods were already transforming the American army. In fact, the very last letter Washington wrote in 1783 as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army was to the Baron von Steuben, thanking him for making a professional fighting force out of his disparate militias. That's how much Washington put out a decree at Valley Forge. No one else can train other than von Steuben. And one of the reasons I really like the man, because as Tom mentioned, he was this Falstaffian character. And Hamilton and Lawrence in particular followed him around like a couple of Prince Hal's following Fat Jack Falstaff, wherever he went. But he also needed them because he had no English. And they were his translators that Washington assigned to him. And so during the drills, von Steuben was a stickler for details. And if someone made a mistake, his face would turn red and he'd start flailing and spittle is coming out of his mouth and he'd yell to Hamilton or Lawrence or whoever was translating, get over here and translate for me in French, because he spoke French. And then a string of oaths and curses in German and French would come out of his mouth. And by the time, say, Hamilton was translating, by the time Hamilton translated all this into English, the soldiers were doubled over in laughter. I mean, they loved this guy. He was one of them. And I think the transformation of the Continental Army began into a real polished force began with the arrival at Valley Forge of Baron von Steuben.
I want to turn to Jefferson for a moment. I feel obliged to at least bring him into the conversation a little. In later life, you can understand why people like Washington and Hamilton and others had some sort of residual resentment about Jefferson and men like him, people who weren't there, who didn't understand the suffering or the esprit de corps that came from that suffering, who didn't really understand the glory of war. Jefferson is a decided civilian in this story.
That's correct. I believe he was in Virginia. Although, when Washington marched the Continental Army into Philadelphia before the Battle of Brandywine, before Howe made his move on Philadelphia, they marched right beneath the rooming house. The windows of the rooming house where Thomas Jefferson had written a Declaration of Independence. But for the balance of the war, it's almost like Jefferson moved men's minds, but Washington made them get up and fight. And the two complemented each other, as I'm sure you're aware. It's just that Jefferson was just a different kind of animal. And although he held the same many of the same beliefs as Washington, as we touched upon before, regarding black soldiers, neither Washington nor Jefferson was particularly religious, which was a little bit out of step for the time. They went to church. Washington was an Episcopalian, but he usually left before the communion. Jefferson, they were both deists, and they were both Virginia planters, so they had that in common. But as far as what Tom calls George Washington the action figure, no, Jefferson was out of that picture.
And one thing that would have impressed Jefferson, and I found fascinating in your book, is Washington's decision to inoculate his troops against smallpox. Can you talk about that?
That shows one of Washington's more forward-thinking decisions, because he insisted
that his troops be inoculated. And you only can look back, you know, in retrospect and think if he had not done that, considering the vulnerability to disease that his troops were because of exposure to the elements, because of starvation, resistance to disease had to be extremely low. And you know, they were suffering from cholera and all other kinds of ailments, that if smallpox had really had a chance to take hold, the Continental Army, you know, that by itself could have rendered the army completely unfit for any further fighting.
Gentlemen, we need to take a short break, but we'll return to this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, everyone. It's Clay Jenkinson, just sneaking in a little announcement between segments of the Jefferson Hour. I want you to join me this winter at Locksaw Lodge west of Missoula for two humanities cultural retreats. The first one, Water in the West, January 13th through 18th, and the second, Shakespeare Without Tears, January 19th through 24th. For more information, go to our website, jeffersonhour.com/tours. We'll see you in the mountains. Welcome back. We're talking with Bob Drury and Tom Clavin about their new book, Valley Forge, which is not a Jefferson book. Jefferson was back in Virginia. I think they rightly say there are different ways to contribute to an American independence movement. These were men of action. Jefferson is more of a man of contemplation, more of a man of language, a statesman, a lawgiver.
You read this book and you understand immediately why Washington gave such weight to Hamilton's opinions. Hamilton was there.
And Lafayette was there. And one of the things
and
that
Jefferson
they say—
And Jefferson was not.
Jefferson was not. Lafayette was the only person who could make George Washington shed his reserve and his stiffness. And when he was around Lafayette, he became playful, physically affectionate. There was some magic between Lafayette and George Washington that he actually shared with no other person, I think, in the whole course of his life. Let's return to the interview. We're talking with Bob Drury and Tom Clavin with their new book, Simon & Schuster, Valley Forge, a fascinating account here. Let me ask a question about Washington again, because he is the central figure of the story. When we look back sort of without any knowledge of the Revolution, we think of Washington as the unanimous, uncontested, admired and loved. That's just not true, and some of this unfolded during Valley Forge. Can you talk about the internecine struggles?
Well, that's one of the largest discoveries, I put it, when we were researching Valley Forge, was that for that winter of 1777-1778, Washington was fighting a two-front war. He was fighting militarily against King George III's Redcoats, and he was fighting for his political life against the Continental Congress, particularly the New England faction, who just wanted to replace him. They wanted to usurp him as commander-in-chief. And they found their opportunity when General Gates defeated the British at Saratoga. And Gates, of course, was a political animal himself. Gates had been born in Britain, had fought for the British in the French and Indian War, and then remained in the United States. He had a farm in Western Virginia, actually today it's in West Virginia. And when war broke out, he pledged his loyalty to the rebels, to the United States. And he kind of expected to be named commander-in-chief. He considered, and when Washington was named instead, that was a political move right there. The New England firebrands, John Adams, Sam Adams, and the like, they realized that without Virginia in the fold, the former colonies, which now declared themselves states, had no chance against the mighty British army. So in order to get Virginia, the most populous state, the largest state, into the fold, they named Washington as commander-in-chief. And Gates harbored a grudge about this, as did General Lee, another British-born officer who thought he should have been commander-in-chief. So after the ill-fated Pennsylvania campaign, where Washington was just rushing willy-nilly, losing battles and at Brandywine Creek, having troops massacred at Paoli, losing the Battle of Germantown, those whispers, the Continental Congress, of course, had fled Philadelphia, and most of them had returned to their own districts, but a quorum of delegates, anywhere from 18 to 23 at any given time, had reconfederated in the inland Pennsylvania town of York. And the whispers about Washington being a military commander, being a bad military commander,
Now they were growing. They weren't whispers anymore. I mean, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a former Washington ally, he wrote this anonymous screed against Washington, calling him a power-mad dictator and a lousy general. And Patrick Henry, as a matter of fact, recognized Benjamin Rush's handwriting, and he informed Washington, who these are the kind of powerful men who are trying to oust you. But Washington just played his hand. He was learning to become a politician on the job, much as he was learning to become a general on the job. When he was first appointed commander-in-chief, he rushed out to buy books on logistics, on artillery, on cavalry. This was stuff he had been a commander himself, a militia commander during the French and Indian War, but he was learning on the job, both militarily and politically. And the smartest thing he did was request that a number of delegates come out to inspect the troops at Valley Forge. And these five delegates, they became known as the Camp Committee. They rode out to Valley Forge, and when York was 80 miles away, they rode to Valley Forge, and when they saw the horrid conditions of the troops, barefoot, starving, and they were so embarrassed, they started taking off their own shoes and giving them to soldiers. Once they realized that Washington was not this power-mad authoritarian figure, he was the only reason that the army was being held together. Washington put them up in a local farmhouse and listed his demands, but he listed them in a way that he made the congressmen, this camp committee, these five delegates, he made it seem like it was their idea that we had to restructure the army. And every day he would send John Lawrence or Alexander Hamilton over to the farmhouse to kind of cajole and hint. And it came to the point where it was almost like the tail wagging the dog. These five delegates were dictating back to the Continental Congress in New York, this is what we need. This is what we have to do. And this was Washington's idea the entire time. He didn't stand up and demand so many of these emotional generals, you know, if you said one bad word about them, they wanted to duel you or demand a court of inquiry or a court-martial to clear my good name. Washington knew he had to play behind the scenes. He had to become a political player, and he did.
We need a mini-series or a blockbuster film on this story. You know, you describe these moments with great cinematic verve and drama. I just see these five members of the Continental Congress appearing in this sea of mud and disease and nakedness and blood and squalor. And I think you say that they were billeted in a house that was near horses that were rotting from dying. This is quite a scene in the middle of this this squalor. Is this headed towards Hollywood?
I think Bob and I are both veterans of this, of the writing game, to know that we have no control over these things. You know, it's like this lightning strike. You know, we have the heart of everything that is. The Last We Heard is being developed into what could be a mini series, and so with this one, you know, certainly, I would certainly agree with you that I think it lends itself now in the age where you have entities like Amazon and Netflix, in addition to the more established ones like HBO and Showtime, is this hungry maw of looking for content, that this would lend itself to. I mean, you have the founding father, I guess you could say, in George Washington as your central character, who, when you think about it, in popular culture, rarely gets represented. You know, we've had a film called Lincoln, and Lincoln is a young Abe Lincoln, and Abe Lincoln of Illinois, and, you know, Lincoln's been represented many, many times in our...
Vampire Killer. Wasn't there a film, Abe Lincoln?
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Killer. So on the big and more recently, the small screen, there's been no lack of Lincoln. But George Washington rarely gets portrayed. And I think here, if anybody's listening to your program that is interested, you have the central figure of being a very human George Washington. I keep emphasizing that because this isn't the George Washington who you see staring back at you from a piece of money, for a portrait on a museum wall. This is George Washington with all his faults and his attributes and his passions and his very, very human emotions, including fear and despair. And then you have surrounding him these iconic characters like Alexander Hamilton and the Marquis de Lafayette and Mad Anthony Wayne and Benedict Arnold. And there really is, yes, a lot of potential for or dramatic presentation of this, what we understood, came to realize, is actually a very dramatic story.
And as Washington looks out on all of this squalor with hints of mutiny and cabals and internecine struggle and the cheating by the purveyors and the profiteering and so on, does at any point George Washington say, to at least to himself, these people don't deserve liberty. These people don't deserve to win this war.
I read everything Washington wrote or dictated for that year. And never, although you can feel the despair in his voice when he's writing, for instance, before Martha arrives, when he's writing to Martha or writing to his adoptive son, Jackie Custis, Martha's son, or when he's writing to his old planter friends who are now politicians in Virginia, you can actually feel the near despair in his voice about, will we make it out of here? But not once did I come across anything of the likes of, look what they're doing to us. We don't deserve the liberty we're fighting for. Or let's just give up now, or let's make peace. And in fact, when other people, when the French got in the war, the British offered the United States liberty in all but name. You can have your Continental Congress. We might even put some of you Americans in our House of Commons. Washington will make you a duke. And never once did he veer from the path of, no, we are the United States and we will remain the United States.
I'm glad you brought up the heart of everything that is. That's how I first became acquainted with your work, and I couldn't heap enough praise on you for that book. I really enjoyed it and recommend it to anybody. If people are interested to find your work, they can go to jeffersonhour.com and we'll provide links. I have to say, one of the things I enjoyed the most about your book was the epilogue. I really appreciated that, and I hope that's taken in the right spirit, but how you went through what happened to everyone, and the fact that Lee was a traitor found out decades, centuries later, and I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, when we were putting the epilogue together, you know, we did remark to each other, "My goodness, this is a long epilogue,"
but
we couldn't find a way, and we let our editor know about this, and I think when we turned it in, we said, "If you see anywhere that we need to cut," but we couldn't think of anything that we wanted to leave out because you have so many characters who have traveled through the previous, 360 pages of the book and the story. And yeah, of course, we know that Washington became a president and served two terms. But, you know, he revisited Valley Forge late in his second term as became a
But
sort of
all that information about Lafayette that no one does know was
right.
just
his
great.
Yes. Imprisonment, and we just couldn't let it go.
It
was terrific.
We were so engaged with these characters that we can't just end the book where they're out of Valley Forge, they take on the British at the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse, the end. We had to follow up.
Right.
We were hoping that people would be so engaged with the characters we wrote about that they would want to. And in fact, many people have kind of echoed your words and say, oh man, the epilogue was great. I didn't know what happened to Matt Anthony Wayne or Nathaniel Green or Lafayette or, well, even Major Andre was hung. I mean, and it was all that Henry Knox. It was funny how many of these men turned out to be wonderful soldiers and bad businessmen.
And the story about the gentleman who rises from his grave every January 1st to go search for... I got to that passage and I had to stop and read it out loud to my wife, and we both chuckled. It was great.
Yeah. We enjoyed the epilogue, but there's also throughout, which I think is a fun... there are the sidebars of the Valley Forge story, which are fascinating. I mean, we do shift scenes to Paris and what Franklin is going on there and how they revered Franklin, yet he was, again, had his own moments of despair whether ever be able to work something out. And perhaps, you know, one of my favorites, if not my favorite sidebar story in the book, is that it was during the Valley Forge encampment that the United States, for the first time, deployed an attack submarine. Right. And that sounds very strange to say that in January of 1778, we had an attack submarine that was capable of blowing up a British ship, but we did. It was called a Turtle, but David Bushnell had created it and even invented a weapon called the torpedo. And there was actually a mission, which is discussed in the book, to blow up Admiral Howe's flagship in the harbor using the submarine and a torpedo. It was the beginning of submarine warfare. And those kind of sidebars, I just love when we were able to include them throughout the book.
Now that story is just so delightful. You, first of all, talk about a low-tech contraption, that the Turtle, but the poor bloke who had to go down to attach the torpedo, and what did you say? It's hour after hour after hour that he's paddling his way against the current.
Right.
By the time he gets to the ship, he's exhausted. It's daylight. Apparently there was some sort of metal on the hull, so he couldn't penetrate the hull. It was a failed mission, but it was a wonderful story.
And he has to paddle all the way back across the harbor as the sun is coming up, and you have these British soldiers and sailors looking over the sides of their ships and saying, looking in the water, saying, "What the heck is that thing under the water?"
One of the things I so admire about your book is that when we look back at these key stories in American history, in retrospect, they often are less mythologically patriotic or less triumphant than they appeared in our school books. But this story holds up, doesn't it? I mean, this story, there are some myths about this story, but the triumph of overcoming these odds to fight again another day, and the esprit de corps that developed because of this this moment holds up to historical scrutiny, doesn't it?
I can't say it any better than you just put it, Claire.
I agree with that. I think it's a very patriotic story in the best sense of the word. That I certainly feel that when the book was done, I did feel an extra bit of pride in being an American. I don't mean in a jingoistic way, but I think that to look back, and Bob said this very early in the conversation, that these were people who were fighting for a cause.
We have so greatly enjoyed this conversation, and the good news is it can happen again. You seem to write a book about once every 3 months, and so come back and be on the Jefferson Hour again. We have a long list of books here: Lucky 666, The Impossible Mission, The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, An American Legend, The Last Stand of Fox Company, A True Story of U.S. Marines in Combat, Last Man Out, which is the next one I'm going to read, The True Story of America's Heroic Final Hours in Vietnam, and so on. Gentlemen, you have been just a delightful interview. We wish you well with the book, and we urge all of the listeners to the Thomas Jefferson Hour to pick up Valley Forge, Simon & Schuster, just out this year, 2018.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Clegg.
We can't thank these two gentlemen enough.
And you made a special point of reminding us about the epilogue, which is a long, interesting chapter.
Oh, wasn't it great?
Remember at the end of a movie when it says this person went on to be an insurance adjuster, and she didn't marry him after all?
Yeah.
And he goes through each of the main characters in the story and then follows that person's career out.
And the fact that they had considered maybe editing and cutting, but they didn't, and I'm so glad they didn't, because it's rare when you read this type of historical account. A lot of them... had a lot of financial troubles, and
you know, and this
wasn't happy for everybody.
The second book in our Jefferson Book Club series, you managed to put off Tacitus one more time by saying we should do this one, right?
We'll talk.
What a great conversation, David. I'm just so glad for this relationship we've formed with Simon & Schuster. We want other publishers to send us their books that relate in any way to the world of Thomas Jefferson. Although Jefferson doesn't come up much in this book and doesn't come up very favorably in this book, nevertheless, it's a really important chapter in the history of the American Revolution, and this is an exciting book. It's not a tedious academic book. These guys know how to write. That's it for today. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.